Hello and welcome to another episode of Politics Theory Other. Before we come to today's episode, just a quick word on a PTO live event that will be taking place next month. On the 16th of May, Richard Seymour will be in conversation with me on the topic of disaster nationalism and the crisis of the liberal international order. We'll be talking about the root causes of the rise of the far right, how the left should respond, and whether what we are seeing is the emergence of a 21st century iteration of fascism. The event is free and will be taking place on the evening of the 16th of May at Space 4 in Finsbury Park, North London. And there should be some additional speakers announced in the next week or two. You'll find a link to book your spot at the event in the description of today's episode. It'll be wonderful to see lots of you there. And now to today's episode. Since October 7th, Israeli politicians, spokespeople, and Israel's supporters have routinely mobilized feminist narratives in defense of the state's genocidal actions in Gaza and sought to portray Palestinian resistance to Israel as suffused with religiously inspired misogyny. In a recent article in Salvage, Sophie Lewis wrote about the way in which Zionist feminists have worked to defend the settler colonial project and how it places them in a long lineage of self-described feminists who have, perhaps surprisingly, been enthusiastic supporters and participants in imperial conquest. In our conversation, we talked about that history and whether we're seeing a decline in Zionist feminism that parallels the broader crisis of liberal Zionism. Sophie Lewis teaches at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research on feminist history, transfeminism, and more besides. She's the author of Abolish the Family, A Manifesto for Care and Liberation, Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family, and forthcoming from Haymarket Books, Enemy Feminisms, TERFs, Police Women, and Girl Bosses Against Liberation. So Sophie, in your recent article in Salvage, you describe Zionist feminism as sharing, quote, key characteristics of colonial feminisms of the 19th century. Can you briefly outline what you see as those characteristics that Zionist feminism shares with those other cases historically where feminism was yoked to imperial enterprises?
Zionist feminism was and is fairly substantially a 19th century colonial feminism in essence. What it holds out to Jewish people, but also in a more particular sense to Jewish women, is a colonial utopia. So it's saying that Zionist women afflicted by life in a patriarchal or an anti-Semitic society in the diaspora can come to Israel and experience freedom. It's a promise for modern souls to sort of quote unquote come home. It's calling on women to actualize a kind of predestined self by sallying forth into the desert where, you know, you can spread your wings or at least stretch your legs on the frontier. And many people have pointed out it's equally about an emulation of imperial whiteness in that sense. A capitulation, it has to be added as well, to anti-Semites' desire to drive Jews out and do away with the diaspora. So for the early Jewish suffragists, Zion was where the exciting physical work of civilization was going to take place. And this work was going to be carried out by proud, pioneering men and women laboring shoulder to shoulder towards the creation of some kind of new human, well, a new Jew, certainly, on land where supposedly no people live. Or if people were already living there, as Palestinians obviously were, then the feminism of this colonial imaginary says that the educational influence of a missionary invasion of enlightened, muscular, virtuous feminists from Europe is exactly what the patriarchal and backward indigenes need, especially, you know, these putatively veiled and extra oppressed women of Islam. To understand all this, I think it's important to think about how at the end of the 18th century, beginning with A Vindication of the Rights of Women by Mary Wollstonecraft, and then developing and changing over the course of the 19th century, British feminism was doing the sort of original version of this. It was consistently making a case for how the empire would be rendered more peaceful, more lovable, how the empire would be stabilized through the strategic deployment of a whole bunch of strong and emancipated, but maternal and patriotic Anglo-Saxon women. The earliest feminism in Britain is about promoting middle-class Anglo-Saxon female emigration, in a sense. Women were supposed to go to places like Canada, Australia, British India, where their mere physical presence, you know, the canny feminists told their perhaps skeptical gentlemen audiences, right? We're going to have a salutary moral and eugenic influence, not only on the colonized, but also on life in the colonial outpost more generally. With Israel, to be sure, there are specific characteristics that have to do with a fantasy of white indigeneity, right? And the eschatological trope of a promised land. So the equivalence isn't exactly, you know, one-to-one, but, you know, there are differences, obviously. For one thing, it's straight colonialism in the case of British India and settler colonialism in the case of Israel. But the Zionist feminists seem to have been consciously imitative of European imperialism. And in both cases, there's this feminist narrative about the special superiority of a particular group in the domain of gender relations.
Would it be also fair to say that both when it comes to Zionist feminism and those other forms of imperial feminism that you describe, that in both cases there's this sense of, you know, out in the colonies, some of the wrongs and iniquities that exist in the metropole can be solved, so that you move to the settler society and you will be more liberated than you were at home?
Yeah, absolutely. This was so common in the periodicals of mid-19th century England that it was also mocked, you know? It was such a common trope that there were satirists kind of reporting on what these excited, optimistic feminists were actually experiencing when they actually got there, where they were hoping they would be, you know, experiencing feminist utopia and, you know, riding around on horseback and having an incredible time, when in fact they weren't necessarily, and they were finding that stultification and patriarchal oppression, both amongst imperialists, their fellow imperialists, and locally, was, you know, still also sucked. Surprise, surprise. So, but yeah, that was very much a narrative for sure.
Coming up to more recent times, so it's perhaps common to see, and this was maybe particularly characteristic of the war on terror and the Afghanistan war in particular, to see feminism as something that is utilized to excuse imperialism, with the targets of US-led wars posited as irredeemably misogynist and mired in religious conservatism in the way that you've described in the older history as well. But you point to the way in which self-described feminist women in the West have historically played much more significant and active roles in the imperialist project. Do you think that that more direct participation of women that you've described has tended to lose its visibility during the late 20th and early 20th century as imperialism shifted from overt colonization to the less direct methods of US imperialism, which tended to avoid permanent rule of foreign territories? And do you think that's maybe why it's become once again more visible in the case of Israel? Because, as many have commented, in some respects, the Israeli settler colonial project seems like something, as you say, rooted in the 19th century, something of an historical anachronism.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a nutshell, that's completely right. So I'll just, you know, reaffirm that the distinction you're talking about between a way of talking about feminisms as co-opted or instrumentalized and a discourse about feminisms as potentially themselves anti-liberatory, you know, as I contend they really can be while still really being feminisms. That's the distinction I'm trying to make in a book I've just finished writing called Enemy Feminisms. Yeah, I hope it's okay to mention this, right?
Yeah,
I'm going through.
Yeah. Plug away.
Okay, great. It's about going through an anti-liberatory women's rights history So from basically this new model English woman of the early 19th century, who I've mentioned, through things like the eugenicist prohibitionists of the white slavery era, then looking at things like the suffragist millionaire May French Sheldon, who went to Tanzania to show the world how to do imperialism feministly prior to becoming a paid apologist for genocide in the Belgian Congo, I kid you not. And then turning to things like the really quite jaw-droppingly radical feminist theology of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan and the feminism of the British Union of Fascists, which a lot of former guerrilla militants in Emmeline Pankhurst's WSPU, you know, they joined, right, in the interwar period. And then looking at the invention of feminist policing, and then the return of what can be called whore phobia in the 1970s, the rise of femo-nationalism, which we can talk about more, and then phenomena like pro-life feminism and turfism, which is obviously a topic I've discussed with you on PTO. And in fact, that suggestion I made back in January, February 2019, that empire has a lot to do with the reason why British feminism has become so anti-trans, was ridiculed by, anti-trans British feminists on social media in a way that surprised even me. You know, I obviously anticipated blowback, but I didn't expect to be told, quote, news flash, women had nothing to do with that whole empire thing, right? And this kind of narrative about women in imperialism having an active and invested role, as you say, has really lost visibility during the late 20th and early 21st centuries because of the way that imperialist methods have shifted, you know, from direct to less direct methods. And there's, you know, there's also a psychic kind of refusal going on there, I think, a disavowal and a rejection of the bitter medicine about how, you know, everything that gets done under the banner of organized womanhood is not, in fact, progressive necessarily. You'd think that we would have gotten past this, given that everyone and their grandmother had a book about white feminism in 2018. But in a way, that was like part of the problem, I think, that the white feminism framing of the conversation sometimes, depending on who, had a sort of really obvious desire driving it to say enough and apologize for enough that one could essentially keep the framing of feminism equals good. You know, feminism is the project of the good guys. And, you know, maybe it left people out. You know, we can be dragged kicking and screaming to acknowledge that much. But by maintaining this kind of vagueness that sometimes, you know, easily creeps in around the frame white feminism, you know, can you lose the feminism without losing the whiteness? Or, you know, is whiteness something you can, in fact, as many people pessimistically want to believe, something you can never lose, right? You can never not be white. That kind of framing allows us, in a sense, to kick the can down the road and not confront how feminisms might have been quite coherent in and of themselves regarding a gender that they wanted to emancipate, you know. The problem then being, the problem is already there in the construction of the gender in a raced and classed way. And these early immigration propagandists are really clear, you know, about how womanhood's power has to be a kind of eugenicist, white supremacist endeavor. And you just cannot separate the two. And you can say that they're being strategic in the way they're pitching stuff to, you know, sexist men, but you can't say that it's not a coherent discourse that they're also investing in completely.
All right, let's go back to the article and the attack on Gaza and the October 7th attacks preceding it. So the October 7th attacks were, of course, portrayed by Israel and many of its supporters as being characterized by systemic sexual violence against Israeli women, alongside some extremely lurid accounts of other forms of violence, much of which has since been debunked. And although the UN's Office on Sexual Violence in Conflict released a report last month stating that there is reasonable grounds to believe that sexual violence occurred on October 7th, the broader claims about systemic, widespread sexual violence seem much less clear. And in your article, you point to an investigation by journalists at The Intercept, which showed the extent to which these claims have been seemingly exaggerated for propaganda effect, most particularly in a report in the New York Times titled Screams Without Words, How Hamas Weaponized Sexual Violence on October 7th. Can you talk a bit about what the Intercept journalists found and how reports of massive sexual violence perpetrated by Hamas fits into the history of similar claims made in order to justify other instances of colonial repression?
Well, reaffirming what you've already gestured towards, the charge of sexual violence very quickly became a pretext for the collective punishment of Gaza. And the claim by representatives of Israel has always been that the Al-Qassam brigades committed systematic sexual violence, and supposedly the almost complete lack of evidence for or first-hand testimony of these rapes was normal in a war zone. So for people like Jill Filipovich in the New York Times, this meant that it's okay to go ahead and print unverified stuff as fact under the circumstances. And also, you know, Israeli police promised tens of thousands of evidentiary cases of rapes by Hamas, and that was months ago. At this point, the story has fallen apart, but no matter, right? Israel has already leveled Gaza. It's already displaced and starved and maimed millions. It's killed well over 33,000. So the job is sort of done, yet unaccountably, some journalists are still circulating really sordid and, yeah, unevidenced rumors about these sort of systematic violations of Israeli girls and women on October 7th, which are similar in tenor to the earlier, as you implied, these earlier rumors about things like 40 beheaded babies, right, now categorically debunked. And all of this has, let's be real, transparently been an attempt to confuse and distract pro-Palestinian activists worldwide, especially pro-Palestinian feminists like me, and to manufacture consent for a genocide. And it has doubtless worked at least somewhat, because Palestinian humanity seems to be impossible to honor in Western state reportage at the very level of syntax. But as you say, people have been tirelessly debunking it. So groups like the New York War Crimes Collective and The Intercept and Mondelez and others, you know, they've been jamming the cogs of this consent manufacturing machine, and they've been releasing really astonishing exposés of Joe Biden's uptake of Israeli Hasbara. And the long conclusive one that I mentioned in the piece that you've just mentioned is by Jeremy Scahill, Ryan Grimm, and Daniel Bogoslaw, really explodes the New York Times report, you know, Screams Without Words by Jeffrey Gettleman, Adam Seller, and Anat Schwartz, which claimed to prove how Hamas weaponized sexual violence on October 7th. And it's so conclusively and shockingly debunked that thousands of subscribers to the Times have sent letters to the editors most responsible for that piece, unsubscribing. You know, and we're asking, why the hell were two total journalism novices, one of whom, Anat Schwartz, had already liked a tweet calling for genocide in Gaza, hired to cover this extremely sensitive issue? And the debunking that the Intercept reporters carry out has been all the more shocking, given how consistently confident and hyperbolic the tone always is behind this mass rape counterpoint thrown by noted feminists like Benjamin Netanyahu himself, right, in the faces of pro-Palestinian activists, right? You know, so if you just think about the title of the Times piece, Screams Without Words, right? Clearly, the claim is that what Palestinian terrorists did is literally, you know, unspeakable, right? Unimaginable. It cannot be captured in words. So, you know, for months it was claimed that Hamas had sliced the fetus of an unnamed victim from her pregnant belly, a classic trope of Islamophobic myth-making, before beheading her and beheading the fetus. But the only problem is that the official Israeli list of the dead doesn't even include anyone pregnant. And meanwhile, I think since I wrote the piece we're talking about, Kibbutz Be'eri has flatly denied the Times' report regarding the sexual assault of two girls in their kibbutz. And now, video evidence of those girls fully clothed rather than in the state described by the Hasbroists, has emerged. And so the Times has added a little update at the bottom. All right. They've not retracted the story nor issued a correction. They've yet to explain why they didn't verify such a serious allegation before printing it. But, you know, all in all these underfunded news outlets trying to sort of resist state stenography and the manufacture of consent for genocide, they've managed to discover that pretty much the whole systematic weaponization of rape story was based on bullshit, right? It was based on avowedly imaginative interpretations of crime scenes by a group called Zaka, an ultra-Orthodox rescue outfit in Israel that's already been documented many times by Israeli sources to spread false stories knowingly. And then it was based on testimony about female corpses from a woman called Shari Mendes, who's an IDF reservist and American architect without any forensic expertise. She worked in a morgue. She simply made up the story about the beheaded mother with the sliced womb. It was based on really inconsistent stories by two IDF soldiers who were at the Nova music festival, right, hiding in some bushes. And they have these accounts of how they saw one woman getting gang raped, although not by Hamas soldiers. And actually, on second thought, they didn't see it. They maybe just heard it. And their story has been changed now at least twice. And then finally, the victim at the heart of the story, the woman in the black dress, she was actually, her family members say, categorically, you know, not raped. And they've said in the Israeli press quite categorically, right, the media invented this. And meanwhile, the video photographer who captured this woman in the black dress was hounded by the New York Times reporters, she says, because it was extremely important, she says, for Israeli Hasbara. The imperial media used language to convey the narrative of unimaginable sexual barbarity on October 7th that smelled a lot like other instances where a lynch mob mentality gets whipped up against a Muslim population. One example here would be the anti-Muslim pogroms by Hindutva fascists under Modi in India. These words really come up. Systematic rape, systematic corpse desecration, right? These words, systematic and coordinated, have been ubiquitous in both these contexts, much as they were ubiquitous in Germany in the wake of this still uncannily, hazily evidenced incident of mass sexual assault in Cologne, right, perpetrated by male immigrant Muslims on New Year's Eve in 2015-2016, which was this, you know, really fascinating, discursive phenomenon, right, when the German government sort of suddenly decided to become, as theorists of femo-nationalism noted at the time, right, a feminist government, right, a feminist state up in arms about misogyny as long as the misogyny is black or oriental. And Islamophobic feminists in Germany did not need evidence to be certain that a giant mob of Arab men on New Year's Eve had been enacting a dress rehearsal, right, they said, for even more serious, nay, lethal forms of anti-Western violence, right, by sexually harassing white women who are out celebrating. Yeah. But I mean,
it's pretty remarkable given the, you know, there's a bit of history there with a different particular population in Germany who were also coded as sexually violent and preying upon white German women, right? I mean, it is extraordinary. Carry on.
Yes, quite. No, I know. It's, you know, to this day, extremely little is known about what really happened, but that didn't stop xenophobic laws being passed, as well as changes to rape law that, from a certain perspective, one could almost say were positive. It, you know, this is the sort of insidiousness of femo-nationalist, right, mechanisms. In these cases, femo-nationalism functions as a kind of spiraling affect of civilizational passion. I don't know, it's a sort of it's an inversion of reality. You know, the powerful are in fact the victimized, the genociders are those at risk of genocide. And this animates, you know, denizens of the imperial court. You know, even in Germany, you know, people are talking about how the West is at imminent risk of Islamization and annihilation, right? It surges up during colonial campaigns that require racist dehumanization and which benefit from the sowing of doubt and hesitation among allies of the colonized, right? But I actually want to say one thing I haven't said before, which is maybe obvious, I don't know. It seems unfamiliar on my tongue, right? And in a way, I think that is a reflection of the way the discursive field is gridlocked by this kind of civilizational, femo-nationalist, anti-Palestinian racism, right? I'm going to say that if Hamas had raped 100 women on October 7th, it still wouldn't justify one single bomb, right? Among the historically unprecedented quantity of mostly dumb bombs, right, rained down on Gaza, bombs that are paid for by my taxes as a US resident. And I think just saying that is to squarely oppose the groups of feminists in the US media who have quite shamelessly declared that, you know, one example I quote is that of all the horrors coming out of Gaza, among the most horrible are the barbaric murders, rapes, sexual assaults, and kidnappings of women and young Israeli girls on October 7th. I mean, there is this kind of, they've put murders in the list as well, but the sentence just blows my mind, right? Of all the horrors coming out of Gaza, among the most horrible, they're sort of suggesting, among the most horrible might be the rapes, right? This was published in Slate on November 30th, when over 15,000 had already been confirmed dead. And I think we're not used to sort of engaging this stuff on its own terms because it's extremely hard to fathom it. But perhaps it's worth spelling out. No, right? No, it is not the case that rape is worse than death, right? That sexual violence is worse than genocide. As a feminist who is fully aware that rape is commonly used as a weapon of war, I just rebel against this. I think we should use the word weaponization, right, of the rape accusation that colonial feminism is so adept at, right? Every fiber of my being rebels against this.
In a different instance of the way in which feminism is mobilized in defense of Israel, in the article, you describe how in the early phases of the attack on Gaza, we saw these rather strange pieces in newspapers on female Israeli soldiers framed, as you put it, as an attractive, youthful band of lesbians and or feminists in combat fatigues. And you refer specifically there to two articles, one titled Lionesses of the Desert, Inside Israel's All-Female Tank Unit from the British Daily Mail, and Israeli Women Fight on Frontline in Gaza, a first from the New York Times. And particularly in the case of the Mail, there's this sort of simultaneous lauding of these women soldiers from a supposedly feminist standpoint, whilst at the same time, there's something extremely male gaze about the whole thing. Can you talk a bit about those articles and whether your sense is that as the genocide has unfolded, there's been less material in this vein, perhaps because it's increasingly ineffective in rallying support for Israel?
Yeah. God. Yeah. In the New York Times, we heard all the usual notes of defense industry girl bossery, right? The idea that woman's touch and a woman's eye are needed to guarantee national security. And someone pointed out to me that this gibberish is actually called the Hillary Doctrine. The Hillary Doctrine is the set of views by Hillary Clinton that girl boss feminism is a national security imperative, I think she says in her TED Talks about this. So the reporters in the Times are noting almost smugly that, you know, male IDF supervisors supposedly ignored some female colleagues' warnings about suspicious activity they'd spotted on the perimeter fence around Gaza that suggested maybe Operation Al-Aqsa Flood might be in the works. And this is, I don't know what this is supposed to make people feel. Should have listened to the girls. They gushed about how then on October 7th, quote, two all-female tank crews once the butt of sexist jokes, hurtled through the desert that morning to help repel waves of armed infiltrators from Gaza. The refrain in the piece is that the debate in Israel on women in the military is so totally over, right? Women with machine guns keep the nation safe. Debate over. Debate over. And in the Daily Mail, you get a slightly different flavor. There's an interview with a strapping lieutenant colonel who is quoted as chuckling about looking a bunch of terrorists dead in the eye and defeating their evil, misogynist, religious atavism with the mere fact of her proud nationalist womanhood. She says, put it this way, they won't be getting 72 virgins. They were taken out by a woman. And in the video clip, there's also this, you know, there's this giant dusty tank with a perfectly posh 20-year-old British member of the IDF standing in front of it. Tamara, right? Fresh from Hendon, North London. It all puts me in mind, I'm afraid, of the long tradition of uniformed feminist fascists in uniform and ex-suffragette British Union of Fascists, police women and so on that I write about in my book. I do think, though, there is less material in this vein, as you point out, in the press outside of Israel itself, at least. Naturally, there are people who will never quit, right? They will never stop posting. There's a professor at Columbia University called Amos Asael who publishes the most bananas op-eds imaginable, right? Straight-facedly proposing that the all-female IDF tank battalions on October 7th, quote, vindicated, right, the theories of Simone de Beauvoir, right? And that was what Hamas was doing, right? It was fundamentally about trampling feminism's very foundations, right? And there's another professor at McGill in Canada, he's called Gil Troy, who's long been absolutely obsessed with the idea that Israel is a feminist utopia. These guys really had to only turn the dial up a little bit after October 7th because it was all ready to go. In 2018, for example, Troy fawningly profiled someone who calls herself the first Israeli-born female rabbi. She's a feminist who is gender critical, right, which is to say anti-trans, and a hardline Zionist. She's called Einat Ramon, and learning about her in that always edifying magazine Tablet, I was reminded of the British TERFs who have tried to propose that TERFism is the new punk. Rabbi Ramon says that her Jewish supremacist nationalism is countercultural, right?
Yeah.
in the same way that her, quote, Jewish feminist womanism supposedly goes against the grain of what she calls postmodern identity politics, right? So, yeah, I kid you not. And then, you know, another example is Eve Barlow in the UK, who seems to think that feminism itself is represented in the cause of Israel exclusively. And there's Aviva Klompas, who is some kind of Capitol Hill communications strategist or policy advisor in the field of strategic Israel engagement. Aviva Klompas, she's a great tweeter of pictures captioned, "These are the female tank warriors who saved us on October 7th, right? Linking to stories about all women Israeli tank crews killed 50 terrorists over 17 hours of combat and so on. And she'll later try and come for Palestinian American Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, right? Who has, she says, no right to call herself a feminist because she's failed to condemn Hamas for sexual violence, you know, simply because, quote, she is blinded by hatred for Israel. And this year on Women's Day, right, the day that was also the occasion for the essay we're discussing, the Israeli defense minister himself, right, Yoav Gallant, met with a bunch of female IDF combatants and announced that the Gaza war proves women can fill more military positions. All of this said, yeah, it is mildly heartening to see that the femo-nationalist gambit has appeared increasingly, well, ineffective or decreasingly effective in rallying support for Israel beyond the die-hard hardcore, right, of pre-existing loyalists.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, thinking about it, I suppose it's, you know, it's one thing to make the argument that it's time for women to take over the project of national security because men have been doing it wrong, as opposed to saying it's time for women to start running the genocide. You know, that's a harder sell, right? Not so easy. On another aspect of the article, it's perhaps more usual to think of Zionist feminism as a project of liberals or latterly parts of the conservative right that are particularly animated by Islamophobia. But in the article, you describe how in the mid to late 20th century, Israel became something of an inspiration to some Jewish American lesbian separatists and radical feminists, in particular Andrea Dworkin, whose work includes Scapegoat, the Jews, Israel, and Women's Liberation. Can you talk about what Dworkin was arguing for in that book and the ways in which Zionism served as something of a model for at least some radical feminists?
Yeah, with pleasure. If that's the word. Before I have a piece about Dworkin coming out in The Point magazine where I don't get to talk about this aspect of, I have plenty of other beef with her, but that I don't get to talk about this aspect, so I'm glad you've asked. But before I talk about Scapegoat, I think it's important to mention that the women's liberation movement in both the UK and the US split in the late 70s and early 80s. I mean, over many issues, but one of the big ones was Israel. So, you know, from 1975 on, in particular, you know, from Mexico to Denmark, there were these feminist world conferences, quite a few of them. You know, it was the UN World Year of the Woman at 1975. And these conferences exploded over votes on so-called Zionism is racism resolutions. Palestinian freedom fighters like Laila Khaled mobilized significant anti-colonial blocks of women throughout this period that resulted in stinging defeats for Zionist feminists. Some of them at these conferences were liberal feminists, like Betty Friedan, for example, who became practically right-wing in reaction to what she experienced, you know, quote-unquote, as a Jew among third world feminist delegates in Mexico. You know, but some were revolutionary American feminists who happened to be Zionists. In the late 70s, movement journals like Dyke, a quarterly, published reflections analogizing Holocaust trauma to the trauma of being a lesbian in the US and analogizing anti-Zionism on the left with opposition to lesbian separatism within feminism. In 1982, there was a Jewish feminist conference, the second Jewish feminist conference held in San Francisco, resulting in a 9-point statement of unity, which affirmed similarities between lesbian separatism and Zionism, while stating any oppressed group is allowed to separate themselves from their oppressors. And, you know, this led to conflict with another group called Women Against Imperialism, many of whose members were, of course, Jewish as well, as you would expect, but all of whom made it known that they were deeply disturbed at the growing tendency to use the issue of anti-Semitism to justify Zionism and the colonization of the Palestinian people. This was all brewing, both sides of the Atlantic. By 1987, Jenny Bourne, the editor of the British journal Race and Class, had published her landmark intervention, Homelands of the Mind, Jewish Feminism and Identity Politics, which is a really decisive left feminist, anti-Zionist position piece. So what she's talking about is in part this development that among Jewish lesbian separatists, the combination of a conspiracist understanding of male supremacy as seeking the annihilation or extinction of all females gets paired with an ethnic identitarian wounded attachment to the threat of a second Holocaust, right? Resulting in this equation where colonial utopianism in Palestine is the only reliable feminist solution. To get to Andrea Dworkin, her penultimate book, published not long before she died. So published in 2000, the year 2000. It represents, I think, the apotheosis of this women equals Jews argument. And what's so amazing about Scapegoat is that it doesn't deny that Israel is founded on occupation and apartheid. It's just that Dworkin announces simply, with a great performance of sorrow, that she's come to the conclusion that this violence is the only way. Right? She hates the masculinism of Israel's colonial violence, but she doesn't hate its underlying justification or deny its underlying righteousness on some level. Right? She explicitly says that the righteousness of Jews' blood-soaked fight for Israel is identical to the righteousness of women who execute their rapists, right? If a woman is raped, Dworkin explains, justifying Israel's defiance of international law, right? Quote, she has a right to retaliate and the state doesn't have a right to intervene, unquote. The human cost of female safety, female nationalist safety, is justified. It's tragic, but the material requirement simply is that women must have their own country to retreat to if necessary.
Because in both cases, it's based on this pessimistic perspective where men or many men are fundamentally misogynist in a way that is not changeable. And in the same way, non-Jews are posited as incorrigibly anti-Semitic.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's what you could call femo-pessimism, right? Or pessimistic Jewishness. It's eternal. I mean, Dworkin would deny this. She says she believes in men's humanity, quote unquote, against all the evidence. She has an intelligent enough mind that she recognizes, at least in theory, the dead end of a sort of ontological misandry, you know? But I'm going to quote the most amazing thing that she says in connection to this, in connection with Israel, right? Quote, I am an enemy of nationalism and male domination, unquote. So this is with remarkable self-awareness, I think. This means that I repudiate all nationalism except my own. Right? This is surely like as good a summary of the liberal Zionist, the fantasized liberal Zionist position, right, as we're ever going to get.
Ethno-states are bad, apart from just this one.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's also really important to connect what she's saying with the shoot and cry phenomenon, you know? We wish we didn't have to do this. It pains us more than it hurt, you know?
All right, so my last question then, Sophie. So you write in the article that at the time of writing, the Zio-feminist camp is riven by defection and chaos, much like liberal Zionism as a whole is, or what is left of it. And you describe some of the reactions from this quarter to Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, those reactions ranging from doubling down on their prior Zionist feminist commitments, becoming even more extreme in some cases, but in others, a shift to apparently ashamed silence. Have you seen any of the more prominent Zionist feminists actually repudiating their previous positions or at least really starting to sort of distance themselves from them? And do you think that both liberal Zionism and Zionist feminism are now in a permanent crisis and headed towards serious contraction and decline as major ideological tendencies?
Yes and no. Changing your mind on something so viscerally felt and wrapped up, or at least packaged, right, in historical generational trauma is difficult. It's scary and shameful to repudiate it. Right. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of people manage, right, and do it, right? To speak only to where I live, in the United States, there are about 8 million Jewish people, and a significant proportion of them are either anti-Zionists now, even though they were raised Zionist, or anti-Zionist because they are loyal to the anti-Zionism of their great-great-grandparents, for example, right? But I've lost track also of the number of friends and comrades and family members, right, whose stories I've heard of disillusionment with Zionism and, yes, also Zionist feminism specifically. I see public renunciations of previously dearly held Zionist identity here and there on social media. For instance, you know, there's the Democratic politician Jen Perelman. I think she's a socialist congressional candidate in Florida who has been speaking about her renunciation of Zionism, which was, I think, a while back. At the same time, the deeply committed Zio feminists or Zionist feminists are silent, I think, hoping that people will tire of resisting genocide. Or else the really, really hardcore are tying themselves in increasingly convoluted rhetorical knots. Leti Cotin Pogrebin was a big player in the women's liberation movement split over Zionism I sketched just now. She has been speaking and writing now over and over and over about her heartbreak, right? That she grieves for the Gazans and yet blames only Hamas for their suffering. She was the co-founder of Ms. Magazine, right? And she was willing to declare, just as Israel was invading Lebanon in 1982, that, quote, Zionism is simply an affirmative action plan on a national scale. Just sort of the, you know, slightly less intense way of packaging that lesbian separatist stuff from Dyke Quarterly about how every lesbian separatist can see herself in Israel. But yeah, 42 years later, right, Leti Cotin Pogrebin's Zionism, while tear-streaked, is totally intact, right? She says she feels, quote, obligated to describe every violent act committed by Hamas on Jewish female bodies, unquote, as a matter of priority. So she's a feminist first, she says, but clearly there's a thing that is more anti-woman in her mind than genocide, and that thing is Palestinian resistance.
You've been listening to Politics Theory Other. If you've been enjoying PTO and finding it useful, please do consider rating or reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. It really does help to bring in new listeners. The show's music and graphic design is produced by Planet B Productions. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.